You're listening to Outside In, a show about the natural world and how we use it. I'm Sam Evans Brown. There's this tendency to think of the natural world as everything beyond the asphalt. Cities are not the natural world, they're the built environment. But you know, the soil is often just a couple inches below the concrete. And the design of our cities represents choices. Choices about how much space we give to built environment and how much space we give to grown environment. That's what we're going to talk about today. Urban trees.
So green spaces and trees, they provide a range of social, environmental, and human health benefits. And so I think if we start with human health benefits, trees, they produce oxygen. So this is something you learn in biology 101 in middle school or high school.
Angel Hsu is an assistant professor of environmental studies at Yale NUS College in Singapore. She's the founder of something called the Data-Driven Enviro Lab.
Trees also provide evaporative cooling and shade, and so that's also really critical from a climate change perspective because cities are getting hotter. So those cities that have experienced the greatest loss in tree cover have also equivalently experienced an increase in urban heat over the same time period. So we see that those are certainly related. And of course, with rising temperatures and less shade and cooling, we have higher incidences of heat stroke, of dehydration. And then trees, they also filter out air pollutants. And so that's also critical, particularly in cities where air pollution is a huge environmental issue. Green spaces have been known to foster social cohesion. They are a place for communities to gather, for example. And so also from a mental health perspective, there have been studies that have shown that there's a close connection between green space and tree cover and also mental health.
This is not big news. Trees, green space, cleaner air, cooler temperatures. We know this is all beneficial. That's why Angel Hsu set out to try to quantify how cities are doing when it comes to preserving and promoting urban trees. So globally, most urban tree inventories are done by census, actual city workers going out and physically counting trees. The data is inconsistent and incomplete, so we don't really have a good picture of how tree cover in cities around the world is changing. Hsu and her lab used satellite imagery to measure tree cover in cities over the last 16 years.
And what we found in this 16-year period where we evaluated tree cover loss, that these cities all across the world have experienced losses in tree cover of about 3,000 square kilometers. And so that's about four times the size of New York City.
But when they looked at their data neighborhood by neighborhood, they found something else. All those benefits that growing trees in your city provide, they aren't shared equally.
So with respect to tree cover deficit, only 27 of our cities actually have sufficient tree cover to their residents on a neighborhood by neighborhood basis. And so that was actually quite surprising. So that means that the distribution of tree cover and green space within cities is incredibly uneven. One of the examples that I often talk about is Los Angeles. And so in Los Angeles, I could show you a side-by-side map, and this is one of the key images that I show when I present this project. But if we look at the distribution of income within Los Angeles neighborhood, side-by-side to the distribution of tree cover access, what we see is that in some of the wealthiest neighborhoods in Los Angeles with average per capita incomes of over $100,000, they have access to 70% tree cover on average. But then some of the neighborhoods with less than $35,000 per capita only have 5% access to tree cover. And so that's a huge disparity, 70% versus 5% tree cover. Citizens systematically in poorer neighborhoods are disadvantaged and have less access to tree cover and green space than wealthier residents within the same cities.
I just want to take a quick step back and talk about the sort of headline finding that there's been this large loss of urban tree cover since the beginning of the study period. What do you ascribe that to?
Yeah, so for developing country cities, I think it's pretty obvious. Urbanization is happening at an incredibly rapid pace, particularly in Asia. And so people who are moving from primarily rural areas to urban areas, but then also cities expanding in and of themselves. So just that expansion is leading to a loss of tree cover. I think in more developed cities, again, it's the conversion of forested or maybe marginal areas that didn't have built structures to built environments that are resulting in the loss of tree cover and green space. that is also making cities more dense, more densely populated, as people then occupy areas that were previously green space. And that's also making cities hotter from a climate change perspective as well. In the US, for example, I think Albuquerque is one of the cities where they have had the highest level of tree cover loss, about 30%. And some neighborhoods have more than 70% loss of tree cover over this 15-year period from 2000 to 2016. So that's really quite surprising, considering Albuquerque is not a newly developing city, right? I mean, it wasn't just founded like some of these Asian cities that are popping up overnight.
So maybe we could talk a little bit about the study that has yet to be released. Perhaps you could just explain the like broad outlines of what you're working on next.
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the benefits that I didn't quite mention previously was that actually also within cities, green space and tree cover have a range of economic benefits. So property values tend to be higher in areas that have access to parks and green spaces and that are shadier and have more trees, for example. But in the United States context, for example, there have been discriminatory practices, redlining, for example, that systematically have kept different income groups and populations from accessing those neighborhoods that have more green space and more tree cover and ergo higher property values and economic value as well. And we found that these policies have led to disadvantages with respect to exposures in urban heat island. And so that the headline finding, which I'm hopefully we'll be able to share with you soon, and we'll have the study released and peer reviewed and published, is that in 97% of these cities, people of color are exposed to higher levels of urban heat than non-Hispanic white populations. So more than 1 degree Celsius hotter.
I did see a study that showed that in places where there are more days that have a really high heat index, that is associated with higher levels of violent interactions with police officers, which in light of the finding you were just talking about seems pretty relevant.
You know, it's really unfortunate, because I think if cities were more intentional in their policies to address some of these environmental issues that are causing disparities, I think there could be other co-benefits, including greater, again, social cohesion and tighter communities and more integrated communities as well.
Angel Hsu is the founder of the Data-Driven Enviro Lab at Yale NUS College in Singapore. Urban tree cover is declining all across the globe. And here in the United States in particular, we're doing a pretty bad job of providing green space for poor people and people of color. So what stands in the way of being better? What are the forces that keep us from making cities cooler, cleaner, better places to live? For some insight into that question, producer Felix Poon looked for a case study. He turned to Chicago.
My name is Lydia Scott. I'm director of the Chicago Region Trees Initiative.
The Chicago Region Trees Initiative is working to improve forest cover and tree health in the Chicago area, a region that has seen a massive decline in urban trees. Since 2010, the city has lost 13 million trees.
Just before the 2010 census took place, we'd had that 2008 recession. And what happened with the recession was that a lot of the municipalities eliminated their forestry programs because they were struggling to make ends meet. And that at the same time, we were at the height of our emerald ash borer problem, where we had this insect in killing 13 million trees in our region. And the result of that was that instead of putting resources into planting trees, they were putting resources into removing trees.
Besides economic instability and pests, it's also just really hard to be an urban tree.
Urban trees have a very hard life. They, and where we live in the Chicago area, we have a lot of salt that we put down on our roads during the winter, and that makes the soils very high in salt. Trees that grow along roadways experience intense heat because of the heat coming off of the roadways. We have compaction of soils because in heavily populated areas, people walk over the root systems on the trees, which makes them struggle to get air and water. And so as a course of that, they have reduced lives, lifespans.
Lydia says that this decrease in tree canopy impacts some communities harder than others. Due to the history of redlining, people of color tend to live where there aren't as many trees.
And when you look down in South Cook County, where you have lower income, higher racial mix in a community, you'll often see a lower canopy distribution in those communities. And we know that, you know, trees provide improved air quality, reduced flooding, improved mental and physical health benefits, habitat for wildlife, reduced heat, all these other benefits that trees provide, that they're not equally distributing those benefits because they don't have those trees in their communities where they have a lower canopy and they have these areas where they have intense pads of concrete where the temperature can be as much as 10 degrees higher in those communities than it can be in communities that don't have those complexes or those intense impervious surfaces that absorb the heat.
The Chicago Region Trees Initiative has a number of ways to encourage urban tree growth and remedy the issues.
We're now working with the Department of Health to identify health issues that are related to that. And the reason that identifying this information is so important is because when you go out to find funding, you have to find someone who's willing to fund your project based on what their particular goals and interests are. So we're just in the process of launching a corporate sustainability partnership program, and that's something that we're just beginning to build.
Another thing they're doing is a lot of educating on how to properly plant trees.
Oftentimes we'll find trees that are planted too deep, and you may think that that doesn't really matter, but it does matter. If the flare, the root flare on the bottom of the trunk isn't at grade, the tree won't die right away, but it will die within 5 to 10 years. And when that happens, you don't often recognize that that's the reason it's died, is because it wasn't planted correctly. And so that's something that we spend a lot of time doing, is teaching people how to plant trees correctly and providing resources to them to show them how to plant them correctly.
And another thing, private property tree ordinances. Lydia says that 70% of trees in the Chicago region are on private property. She brings up a particular Hollywood actor to illustrate her point.
1987, I believe, which has been a long time ago, an Los Angeles actor moved here to actually the community I live in, named Mr. T.
Was that the Mr. T that you're talking about?
The Mr. T, yes.
I Pity the Fool, Mr. T?
That one, yes. And he immediately came in and cut down 150 mature oak trees on his property because he didn't want the trees on his property. And that launched the entire region into chaos as to how do we stop somebody from doing this. Because at that time, this community did not have a regulation in effect that could prohibit a private landowner from removing all the trees on their property if they wanted to. And so as a result of that, we saw a number of communities implement private property tree ordinances. And so when I mentioned before that we have tree ordinance templates, we have what's called bronze, silver, and gold. And the gold level tree ordinance is the one that includes private property regulation of trees, because 70% of the trees in a community are on private land. So that 70% of the benefits that they're receiving as a community are because of private landowners. And they don't understand that it's a joint or a collaborative resource. So, for instance, you know, if you change the grade on your property, you have to go get a permit to do that because there's a likelihood that you're flooding your neighbor's property. But in most communities, if you decide you want to chop down the tree that's there sitting between those two properties, you don't have to do anything about it, yet that tree intercepts tens of thousands of gallons of water every year as it, you know, as rain develops, or it reduces your energy bill by, you know, tens to hundreds of dollars a year based on, you know, the canopy that you have. I think, you know, if I could leave a message with people, it is that trees really are integral, important parts of our everyday lives. And we take them for granted. And they have a term called tree blindness, where you don't know or recognize that those resources are there for you and they're helping you on a daily basis. So we need to be focused more on improving quality of life in our communities, and oftentimes we can do that with our trees.
That was Lydia Scott, director of the Chicago Region Trees Initiative.
The life of an urban tree is hard. So it's no surprise that urban foresters have historically relied on very hardy trees. After a break, an ode to one such tree. This is Outside In. I'm Sam Evans Brown. And today on the show, we've been talking about urban trees. One urban tree that you'll see in a lot of places is the ginkgo tree, which we did a podcast episode about in 2016. Producer Felix Poon has a personal relationship with the tree and pointed out to us that our story, frankly, wasn't great. In this story, we discuss offensive language that we've used on the show in a previous episode. There's also a discussion of racism, and there's an ethnic slur. All this language is bleeped, but if you've got kids, you might expect to have a conversation about what they've been hearing. Okay, here we go.
They say that smell is the sense that most closely relates to memory. And when I smell ginkgo berries, it smells awful. And yet, I'm transported back to memories when I was a kid. Back to these road trips I would take with my family to Boston. We would go eat dim sum in Chinatown, explore the Museum of Science, and visit my grandfather's grave at Forest Hills Cemetery. As a Chinese-American family, visits to the cemetery are not somber affairs. They're exuberant picnics. My uncles crack absurd jokes. Everyone laughs. We pour wine over the soil and talk to the deceased as if they're just there hanging out with us. And we eat some of my favorite foods. Barbecue pork, roast duck, soy sauce chicken, and egg tarts. And the reason why the smell of ginkgo berries brings me back there is because after one of these trips to the cemetery, when I was about 5 years old, we drove down the winding driveway under an October tree canopy as we were leaving the Forest Hills Cemetery. And the adults see something on the ground. And they stop, and they are excited. That's my Aunt Susan saying, "Wow, ginkgo berries, ginkgo berries, this is great. We can make desserts and soup." I call her because I don't remember all the details, so I need her to fill in the gaps. She says my mom, my dad, my other aunts and uncles, they all grabbed whatever plastic bags were in the car, got out and started scooping these things up. Now my sister, my brother, and I, we were just kids, going along with whatever the plan was with these ginkgo berries. And the plan was to bring them to my grandma's apartment in Chinatown to clean them and eventually to eat them. Aunt Susan says the neighbors yelled at us. "It's so smelly. What'd you bring back?" the neighbors said. I ask Aunt Susan, "But aren't the neighbors Chinese too?" She said that's how they knew they were ginkgo berries. They yelled at us, "Don't pick ginkgo berries. Just go to the grocery store and buy them. Because at the store, they're already cleaned and processed, so they don't smell." Ginkgo berries are used in kanji, or Chinese rice porridge. Now, kanji isn't my favorite food, nor are ginkgo berries, but they're a comfort food for me. Something that my mom, who's since passed away, used to cook for us when we got sick. It reminds me of home, of family. Fast forward to a couple weeks ago, when we started planning to do a show on urban trees, and I found out that Outside In did a whole podcast episode on ginkgo trees in 2016 called Ginkgo Stink. And at first, I was really excited because I don't actually know all that much about ginkgo trees or ginkgo berries. All I know is what it means to me personally, that it reminds me of being a kid and going on these fun road trips to Boston and visiting my grandma, eating good food. So I went back and listened to the episode, which starts off with people describing the fruit.
Well, the word ginkgo actually means white apricot in Japanese, but I think they sort of look like oversized albino cherries.
And the stench.
A sewer. Pretty horrid.
And that's familiar for me, because I can relate to how truly awful the smell is.
Vomit berries, stink berries.
And then someone describes the fruit.
She's written about ginkgo berries for the Washington Post.
As fruit.
That's another one. It's just so many.
And Sam Evans Brown and Taylor Quimby, who produced the show, go on to call it
fruit
for the rest
with fruit
of
fruit
the episode.
You just want to experience it. You want to broaden your horizons by sniffing.
Each time I hear them say fruit, I tense up in my body, and by the end of the episode, I'm actually shaking a little. This is food that I eat and that my family eats. And the older Chinese immigrants I used to see when I first moved to Boston with their white buckets full of ginkgo berries that they eat. Shit fruit. Hearing it called that, it hurts. It just brings me back to the part of my childhood when I was bullied for being Asian. So I call up Anita Manure. She's an associate professor of English and Asian American Studies at Miami University in Ohio. I call her because I want to talk to someone about the visceral reaction I had to the episode and the history of what she calls culinary racism. She gave me an early example of this, an influential paper co-authored by the celebrated founder of the American Federation of Labor in 1902.
The head of that, Samuel Gompers, released this now famous treatise called Meat versus Rice, which is the stupidest title of anything ever.
Right.
But basically, one of the things he was making an argument for is that the presence of Asian labor drives down the value of American white labor, right? And so part of the reason Americans make for superior workers is that we are a class of meat eaters, whereas Asians are rice eaters.
This treatise reflected cultural and racist fears about whiteness and manhood. Gompers had publicly advocated for the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882, which barred Chinese people from entering the country.
And this sort of continues, right, in California in terms of like narratives of hygiene, right, saying that we need to make sure that Asians are sort of stay in place because they are contributing to the filth and dirt. Look at the things that they eat. There are these cartoons that depict Asians eating rats and things like that. Mm. Not unlike the kind of things that we are seeing now, you know, with COVID-19 of like Asians eating bats, et cetera, and all the sort of nonsense around wet markets.
Anita says there's a long tradition of racializing immigrants as other, not just based on how they look, but how they smell.
I mean, and this goes back to like even medieval Europe, right? There's this term photor judaicus, which basically comes from medieval Europe. That's this sort of idea that Jewish bodies give off an unpleasant smell, right? But it becomes part of a sort of a pervasive cultural logic that reminds people that they don't belong.
Anita and I both have personal experience with racist bullying. In fact, we spend a lot of our calls swapping stories about the racist bullying we experienced growing up. None of it was like food related for me. Like my experiences were typically like, you know, I think what a lot of East Asians experience growing up is like white kids like pulling their eyes back and saying ching chong. Or, you know, there was this weird incident when I was in second grade and my teacher said nobody has black hair to the class. And everyone was like, well, what do you mean? What about Felix? And she's like, oh, Felix doesn't count.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. And then in middle school, I had a family friend and our vice principal called him a chink. So those all terrible things, but like none of them really relating to food. I think my experience with food racism has been more kind of in the realm of pop culture. Right? Like stereotypes of Chinese people eating dog, or these days bats and civets, all sorts of weird things. And so in the Ginkgo Stink episode, hearing them all refer to it as shit fruit.
Oh God, it's, yeah. That was disturbing when I heard it too. I had a visceral reaction to it.
Yeah, well maybe tell me about your visceral reaction. Like what was that about?
Yeah, so it's interesting listening to your history. For me, it was the opposite. So my first experience in a non-Asian place was in my school. And I remember that my mom would give me Indian food to take to school, right? I feel like this is a fairly typical story, at least in terms of what I've read in all of my research. And, you know, it was like this metal tiffin container and she'd put like rice and some kind of Indian curry. And I remember just being like, I hate it because people would be like, ew, what's that? What are you eating? You know, that looks so weird. So I remember asking my mom, I was like, could you not make this food for me? It's embarrassing. And so I remember like hurting her feelings pretty deeply. She's like, okay, she's like, well, what do you want? I was like, well, a lot of kids are eating tuna fish sandwiches. So she was like, okay, I'll make you tuna fish. And like in my head, it was like tuna fish salad, right? Like white mayonnaise, whatever. So she's like, you know, the day comes, I'm very excited that I have tuna fish sandwiches. I open my lunchbox and I see these this white bread, and in the middle of it is this bright yellow stuff. Because my mom has made tuna fish curry, which is delicious, by the way. And so it was just, and my friends were like, what is that? And I was like, it's tuna fish. And they were like, ew, it's gross. Why does it smell so bad? Yeah. And like, you smell like curry. And so to me, it just became this moment of not, because it was sort of like I had hoped it would be this moment of assimilation, right? Not calling attention to myself. But in fact, it became this moment of failed assimilation, right? Because I had taken the thing that was so familiar and done it so horrifically wrong. So then I became, you know, like even more of an outsider.
Anita and I discuss a variety of Asian foods that have been subjected to this treatment. Indian curry, durian, natto. But with all those foods, smell is in the nose of the beholder. Especially if you grew up eating it, you may think that durian smells great. But when it comes to ginkgo berries, I'm reminded of my family and grandma's neighbors. All Chinese, all eat ginkgo berries and either love it or don't mind it. All say it smells terrible. So what's wrong with calling it shit fruit, if that's what it smells like?
It just accesses a whole history of racial narratives that sort of remind you of your otherness. And what can feel, in a sense, so profoundly alienating is to be told that you don't belong, not just because you look different, but because you smell different. So with ginkgo, I think it's something similar, right? That when the term fruit in particular is used, it feels like it's also, you know, mapping onto the bodies of the people who eat those foods.
I think about what Anita's saying and how stinky cheeses map onto the people who eat it. It's got the opposite cultural effect. Eating stinky cheeses gives you cultural capital. It exudes an air of class. No one calls stinky cheeses shit food. And that's just it. For me, it's one thing to say that ginkgo smells like shit versus saying ginkgo is shit fruit.
Yeah, but I think that's a really good distinction, right? Sort of like the sort of like saying it is this thing, like that is what its profound essence is, as opposed to it smells like
my family only picked ginkgo berries that one time. Aunt Susan tells me it's just easier to buy them at the store, already processed, no longer stinky. And it's been a long time since I've seen anyone else in Boston picking ginkgo berries. The Philadelphia Inquirer reported the same trend in an article called A Philly Tradition Fades, published in 2014. I'm telling this story in the month of June. June is the month my mom passed away in 2013, and Forest Hills Cemetery is literally just a block away from where I live now in Boston. When I go there to visit my grandfather, my grandmother, and my mother, I still look over to the spot where the ginkgo trees used to be. And even though it smells bad, I still try to remember what the ginkgo berries smell like, because I don't want the memories to fade. I want them to linger. I want to remember.
When Felix listened to our original ginkgo episode, in which the berries were, over and over, referred to as shit fruit, and told us about our blind spot, we talked about what to do. Retire the episode? Disappear it? Instead, we've opted to own up to the mistake and try to correct it. Update the episode, which was supposed to be a celebration of the amazing ginkgo tree, so that it sounds like that, to everyone who listens. Coming up next, you'll hear our attempt to do just that. Welcome back to Outside In, a show about the natural world and how we use it. We've been talking today about trees, urban trees in particular, and for this next story, originally aired in 2016, we're focusing on one species of popular urban tree, and producer Taylor Quimby is here to tell us the story.
So
This is a story that could start in a lot of places, I think, but I'm going to start with this guy named Mike Rafferty.
Yes, I'm Mike Rafferty. I live in Chicago in the Lakeview neighborhood.
He works downtown.
I do computer work for a financial institution here.
And part of his daily commute to work used to take him alongside the University of Illinois Chicago.
A basic college campus type environment. There's lovely trees and some open green space.
And hanging over the street on the grounds of the campus is this big, beautiful ginkgo tree. Now, have you ever seen one?
I think there was one on campus at the college that I went to.
They're most recognizable because of the leaves. So their leaves have this very distinctive fan shape that is unlike any other leaf of any other tree. And they're considered to be just incredibly beautiful trees.
Got it.
Okay, so Mike Rafferty, he walks by this tree every day.
A very pleasant walk most days.
Except in the fall,
these lovely ginkgo trees, which were perfectly nice trees most of the year, would start dropping these smelly,
stinky
pods.
These like fruit berry thingies.
Down on the sidewalk and grass that I had to walk through.
So what do they look like?
Well, the word ginkgo actually means white apricot in Japanese. But I think they sort of look like oversized albino cherries. But yeah, they stink really, really, really bad. They smell like vomit, I guess.
like a sewer. It's pretty horrid.
Or some people say they smell like poop.
I've heard the berries called vomit berries.
This is Sadie Dingfelder. She's written about ginkgo berries for the Washington Post.
It's just so many. I mean, it's like you walk and it's like little pebbles everywhere.
And not only do they smell awful, but they're slippery. You step on them. They, like, coat your shoes.
It would get in the gutter of the street.
They sort of smush under your feet nicely.
Cars would drive through it, smash it, grind it up.
It makes it sound like these sidewalks are like a battlefield.
It is certainly a public nuisance. If you had a family in a home throwing stuff like that out there on the sidewalk, I can pretty much guarantee the city would be there ticketing you every day for doing so.
Now, you may not have put much thought into this, but this tree, it wasn't always here. You know, like every city tree was planted right where it stands for a very specific purpose. It's not an accident.
So if this tree is such a colossal pain in the nostrils, why are people still planting it? Is it worth it?
Well, that is kind of the question I'm going to try and answer in this story. And to do it, I'm going to tell you about one American city that's been grappling with ginkgo stink for a century and reveal why we started planting them in the first place.
So you're going to try to answer my question?
What are you? Why are you giving me flack? You know we wouldn't be doing this if it wasn't complicated.
So it's a fruit that smells like vomit.
It's technically not a fruit because they're gymnosperms. They're not angiosperms.
That is the voice of Tom Kimmerer. Now, he is a tree physiologist, and he's our ginkgo expert for this story.
We can call it a fruit for our purposes. It smells like dirty sweat socks, and that's not a coincidence. The odor is the odor of butyric acid, which is what accumulates in dirty sweat socks.
Butyric.
Yeah.
Do we know what that comes from?
The word?
Yeah.
No. I don't even know how to spell it.
Yeah.
How do you pronounce the acid?
Butyric acid.
Butyric acid.
B-U-T-Y-R-I-C. Butyric acid.
Now, Tom explained to me that one reason that this issue is so divisive is that not all ginkgos have this berry problem. And that's because, and this is very important, ginkgos are what we call dioecious.
What does it mean?
Dioecious. That is, they have sexes on separate trees. So there are male ginkgos and there are female ginkgos.
And only the female trees produce the berries. Now, dirty sweat socks aside, there are a ton of reasons to plant a street tree. They beautify the city, of course. They reduce traffic speeds. They increase walkability. They reduce crime, all of which means better economic growth in downtown areas. And like I said, ginkgos are gorgeous. You remember Sadie?
Hi, I'm Sadie.
I remember Sadie.
Well, Sadie lives in Washington, D.C., and she loves ginkgos.
Since they drop all their leaves all at once in the fall, they just carpet the city sidewalks with gold, you know? It's like living in the gilded capital It's really beautiful.
Now, D.C. has had a pretty sizable population of ginkgos since at least the 1870s.
Our Department of Agriculture was an early pioneer. They loved ginkgos. They planted 90 ginkgos that lined the pathway to their front doorsteps.
Today, there are thousands of ginkgos in D.C., including 925 females. So in the fall of 2014, the female ginkgo started fruiting, as they do every year, and Sadie decides to write about it for the Washington Post Express, which got her wondering, how many other reporters have written about this same problem over the years?
I decided to look back into our archives, and
she says that the newspaper has published an article referencing its ginkgo trees every year.
Well, at least one, since 1904.
Here's just one example.
December 27, 1914, it says, there's not much spooning in the moonlight around the ginkgos after the first part of October, unless a lass and a swain happen to be employees of a tannery or some other highly scented place.
News writing's really, really gone downhill since those days.
I know, hasn't it?
In D.C., you can actually, if you get 60% of the people on your city block to sign a petition, you can get a female ginkgo tree removed and replaced with a male ginkgo tree, which seems like sexism, obviously. But it's also, like, very divisive in neighborhoods. Like, some people, you know, are so offended by these berries that it seems like a no-brainer. And other people are like, these are beautiful trees. Like, you know, we need to protect them, not cut them all down.
So let's recap here. In Chicago, you have one guy complaining about a stinky ginkgo tree, but it's not really a widespread problem, so nobody really cares.
As far as I know, the trees are still there.
Sorry, Mike. In D.C., you can have a female ginkgo tree removed if you can corral the whole block into signing a petition.
That's not easy to do.
In some smaller cities, Iowa City, Easton, Pennsylvania, for example, they've just chopped most of their female ginkgos down or banned them from being planted altogether. But probably the most ridiculous solution comes from Seoul, South Korea, where the ginkgo is actually the official tree. They planted thousands of them in like the early 70s. They started getting complaints every fall until they started cutting them down. Now, I've read different accounts. It looks like they still have at least 140,000 ginkgos on their streets, many of them female. Every year, they deploy more than 440 workers who pick all of the berries before they fall to the ground.
Oh!
This costs thousands of dollars. It is a huge, huge manpower problem. It's crazy.
So the fruit's not edible, is it?
Well, there is a nut inside the fruit that is edible once it's been processed, and it's used in some Asian soups and congee or eaten as a snack. And it should be said that arguing over the berries, which, yes, do smell, is one thing, but making fun of or othering food from another culture or region of the world is not okay. And to break the fourth wall here for a minute, I said some insensitive things in a previous version of this story that did that very thing. We labeled the ginkgo berry as something gross and other. We called it a quote-unquote fruit a bunch of times. And in the process, we hurt people for whom the ginkgo berry is a part of a cultural tradition. This was not my intent. I feel terrible about it. So we've cut those bits out, but we don't want to paper over our mistake either. Ginkgo berries may smell, but that doesn't make them shit. And to anybody that heard that first version, I am really sorry. I'm committed to being more thoughtful about how I approach my stories, and we as a team are committed to being more careful about our editing process going forward so that it doesn't happen again. So, to get back to the story here, about the ginkgo as an urban logistics problem, you've got some folks arguing that the female trees should be cut down, others who like them, and some who are bypassing the discussion and taking matters into their own hands. So, Sam, you remember Tom Kimmerer?
Mm-hmm. I'm speaking to you from the University of Kentucky campus, and there was a female ginkgo at a fraternity house, and late one night the boys girdled the tree and killed it. And I think that's pretty common for people to vote with their chainsaws against female ginkgos. We've all stepped in dog poop at some time, and we try to get people to clean up after their dogs, but they don't always, and there's always dog poop in our landscape. We don't say, oh, there's dog poop in our landscape, let's get rid of all the dogs. Well, that's what we're saying about ginkgos.
So cutting them down is sad, but if they're so controversial, why would a city want to plant them in the first place?
So to answer that question, you have to go back a couple hundred years.
yes, it actually starts in England in the early to middle 19th century.
And at that time, there was like more than a million London residents. All of them are burning coal.
You know, you read about the London fogs, or you see them in Sherlock Holmes videos. That wasn't fog, that was smog, that was air pollution.
And it was so bad that it was like killing people because of respiratory illnesses, but it was also killing all the trees in the city.
Ginkgos had been found in China, found by Western botanists. They'd always been known by Chinese botanists.
And they planted them at Kew Gardens, which is like this big, gorgeous botanical garden in London that's been there for ages. And those ginkgo trees just thrived where all these other trees were dying.
So it gained the reputation in Europe as being a tree that tolerated air pollution. It also tolerated the kinds of soil compaction and other problems that city trees often have.
So ginkgos are these superhuman survivor trees. In fact, after we dropped the atomic bomb on Hiroshima during World War II, there were 6 ginkgo trees that were located right near the epicenter of the blast. And you can see pictures where, I mean, the landscape is just destroyed. But those trees sprouted new leaves shortly after the blast, and they're still alive today.
That's insane.
Yeah.
And it's a fact.
Yes.
So, okay, so they're just incredibly burly. They can handle nuclear bombs. They can handle horrific coal pollution. They can handle terrible soil.
Yeah, and aside from humans, they can also handle all of the living things that might potentially try and kill them too.
What do you mean?
Well, ginkgos are what we call a living fossil. Do you know what that means?
We thought it was extinct, but it's not?
Not quite. It means that it's a living species that is also on the fossil record, because that living species has changed so little that it existed in a nearly identical state thousands or in some cases millions of years ago. So alligators, sharks, horseshoe crabs, those are all different types of living fossils. And ginkgo is one of our oldest living fossils on record. Ginkgo's ancestors go back like 270 million years, which is 40 million years before the first dinosaurs. Back then, at its height, ginkgo covered the northern hemisphere.
So basically what ginkgo did was it retreated from being worldwide in distribution to these little tiny patches in China and essentially outlived all their enemies. I'm sure at one time, I'm sure that you could look at fossilized ginkgo leaves and find evidence of insects that fed on them and fungi that grew on them. Those are all gone now. They have effectively no insect or disease problems.
And that really does matter. So even if you're not in, you know, 19th century London, or you're like in post-World War II Hiroshima, like urban trees, trees that live on our city streets do not have a long life expectancy.
Trees that are capable of living hundreds or even thousands of years
in a forest
may only survive for a few years in the urban landscape.
There's the soil compaction.
Damage by mowers.
There's diseases.
Damage by fertilizers and herbicides.
Bugs.
And pesticides.
There was a study from 2006 that showed that as many as 63% of urban trees in Philadelphia were dead or removed within 10 years. Ginkgo is like this dinosaur, like a Tyrannosaurus rex that got plucked from the past and stuck on a savanna today. Nothing knows how to kill it.
It's the apex tree.
It is the apex tree of millions of years ago and somehow still today.
Yeah.
And as far as a lot of urban foresters are concerned, like, there's really no downside to planting a ginkgo as your street tree. And this is why Manhattan, Tokyo, big cities around the world are planting hundreds and in some cases thousands of ginkgos.
Okay, so let me ask you a question.
Shoot.
If one of the only downsides to planting ginkgo trees in cities is the smell of the berries, and only the females produce berries, why not just plant males?
Well, for years now, that is what people have been doing, or trying to do anyway. But the problem is, you can't tell whether a ginkgo tree is male or female until it matures. And that can take like 20 years. So what plant nurseries do is they find a male tree and they clone it. Technically, it's called grafting. It's not a very complicated process. But this way, anyway, nurseries can sell a city hundreds or even thousands of young trees, all of them exact copies of the male that they originally cloned in the first place.
So that sounds pretty good.
Yeah, but once you start digging into the ginkgo question, you'll find a number of cities
who thought they were planting all certified male clones in the 80s or the 90s, only to find, 20 years later, some of the trees are female.
So are the nurseries lying or something?
That's a possibility, but probably unlikely in most cases. It's also possible that the nurseries have just screwed up the grafting process and they're accidentally selling a few female trees here and there. But there is another reason that even if they clone the trees perfectly, cities will still end up dealing with the stink problem.
And that is?
Well, first, let me ask you a question. Have you ever seen Jurassic Park, Sam?
So Jurassic Park used to actually be my favorite movie. And as a 12-year-old, I used to watch it, finish it, and then rewind it to watch it again. So, yes.
Okay, well, in that case, then you are probably going to remember that in Jurassic Park, there was a containment measure that they had so that the dinosaurs would not breed on the island. The containment measure was that they made sure they only had female dinosaurs.
We control their chromosomes. It's really not that difficult.
I know exactly what we're talking about.
Yeah, and Jeff Goldblum, the guy, the very cool, you know, like hip mathematician character, was all like, you know, if there's one thing that evolution taught us,
it's that life will not be contained. Life breaks free, it expands to new territories, and it crashes through barriers painfully, maybe even dangerously, but, well, there it is.
You're implying that a group composed entirely of female animals will breed?
No, I'm simply saying that life finds a way.
And of course, later in the movie, you know, Grant, played by Sam Neill, and those two little kids are, you know, like trucking through Jurassic Park. They're all beat up.
You know what this is?
And sure enough,
it's a dinosaur egg. The dinosaurs are breeding.
So just to be clear, in Jurassic Park, you have a population of genetically cloned organisms, all of them bred to be female, but then some of them spontaneously change sex and they start producing offspring. And, well, basically, that's what happens with the ginkgo trees.
They just switch. There's some that just switch.
Trees, like fish, can occasionally change sex. We don't know the frequency of that sex change in ginkgos, but my suspicion is that most of the female ginkgos that we see in the landscape today were actually planted as males.
But regardless, this is all one way of saying that no matter how reliable the nursery is, like no matter how well you clone the males, no matter if you spray the trees, it doesn't matter how hard you shake them, like you cannot guarantee with all our human ingenuity that we can only plant male trees and get what we want out of a ginkgo without a chance of getting what we do not want, which is a bad smell.
Hmm. Nature wins.
Yeah.
Malcolm was right. Life found a way.
There's a part of me that thinks, how awesome is this? Like, how awesome is this dinosaur of a tree that produces a fruit that once upon a time may have been eaten by a stegosaurus and spread around that way? Like, that is the point. The point of the smell is probably to attract some sort of animal that is long extinct that would eat it, then go somewhere else, poop it out, and spread the seeds.
Oh, so that's interesting. I hadn't thought about that. Like, why this is advantageous to have something really smelly? That might smell delicious to a stegosaurus.
Exactly. And there's something about the fact that this tree exists in our landscape at all that is so incredible. And rather than just see it as like an ornament to be, you know, strung up for our convenience, I want to think of it as a uncontrolled living organism that is both beautiful and smelly, and reminds us of our place in the world. Because ginkgos, as incredibly successful as they were historically speaking, they are, for all practical purposes, extinct in the wild. But there are thousands and thousands of them across cities all over the place. This is like Jurassic Park. It's like a reminder of the world that used to be here.
That was producer Taylor Quimby and I in a story we originally aired in 2016. This episode of Outside In was produced by Felix Poon, Taylor Quimby, Justine Paradise, Molly Donahue, Logan Shannon, Megan Tan, and me, Sam Evans Brown. Our executive producer is Erica Janik. Special thanks to Asia Downton, Assistant Professor of Urban Forestry at Michigan State University. Music in this episode from Blue Dot Sessions and the Daniel Pemberton TV Orchestra. Our theme is by Breakmaster Cylinder. If you'd like even more from the team at Outside In, you can sign up for our newsletter or follow us on social media. You can find the links to all of that at our website, outsideinradio.org. Outside In is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.